coming up on Boston Public Radio. First off, as the jury gets the case, it's everything you wanted to know about the Bulger trial but were afraid to ask with GVH's Adam Riley. And then how a cardboard cutout cop is fooling bike thieves at the LYFT station. Then the doctor in charge of emergency preparedness at Brigham and Women's talks of lessons learned from the marathon and changes ahead.
Charlie Baker, who used to run Harvard Pilgrim, gives us his take on some surprising hospital safety ratings. Is it best to go to famous hospitals for surgery or not? Who doesn't love a good burger? But are you ready for a test tube burger that costs $300,000? And then our own local Houdini tells us how she, yes, she, performs underwater escapes from multiple... He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So after nearly 2 months of testimony from gangsters, FBI agents, and relatives of murder victims, the jury's got the case and office pools on how long they'll be out abound. So as we wait, we thought it was a good idea to look back at the trial many thought would never happen. Here to answer our questions and yours at 877-301-8970. We're calling this Everything You Always Wanted to Know About the Bulger Trial We're Afraid to Ask is GBH's Adam Riley, who spent much of the last month inside the Moakley Courthouse. Adam, good to see you.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Adam. Well, here's what I'm dying to know. Jay Carney, great defense lawyer. We all know that. But I can't quite figure out what his strategy is. He seems to be saying that Whitey Bulger, who supposedly killed 20 people, was actually a victim of the corruption of the government.
I think
was
19,
corruption.
Right?
Okay, 19.
It's
19.
Easy to lose track.
Okay. Okay. 19. But he was a victim of the government and therefore should be acquitted. Is this where Carney's going or what?
Yeah, I guess if you want to sort of reduce it to its core essence, which sounds kind of absurd when you put
absurd,
it that way, right?
Absurd, yeah.
I mean, my
it's
hunch
not absurd.
Is
the immunity defense without being allowed to do the immunity defense,
that's
isn't
a very
it?
Good point.
Yeah.
And just for listeners who may not know what we're talking about,
sure.
The defense team had wanted to argue that Whitey Bulger had been granted immunity or believed he'd been granted immunity by former U.S. Attorney Jeremiah O'Sullivan, including license to kill. And Judge Denise Casper did not let him make that argument in court. So that's a good way to think of it, actually. The way they framed it, though, I got to say, the way they framed it yesterday was a little more, I mean, I think you're correct, and it sounds ridiculous when you lay it out that way. But the argument that they made during their closing arguments yesterday was pretty good. Basically, it was that, like John Connolly before him, Whitey Bulger is being made a fall guy for a bigger sort of conspiracy of silence and corrupt marriage between the federal government and organized crime that the federal government still refuses to come to full terms with.
Yeah.
Not that Whitey Bulger didn't do bad things. I mean, I think the defense has either overtly or implicitly acknowledged that he dealt drugs and extorted, and they've pretty much, you know, decided not to fight most of the murder charges that he's facing. But I think what they wanted to do is say, this is really much, much bigger than Whitey Bulger, and you should know that the federal government, against the defense's point of view, the feds are rotten to the core, and they still won't tell you how rotten they are.
Can I say something? I don't find it nearly as ridiculous as you do, Marjorie. I mean, first of all, they have virtually no defense, but here are the two things they
right.
did. They did this, it's the feds, it's not my guy. And number two, they did what we knew they'd do. This is in J.W. Carney's closing argument yesterday. They did what we knew they'd do, is the government, with your money, has bought the testimony of witnesses like Weeks, Fleming,
right.
and Martirano.
But, people who
what
else
have they
killing
got?
But I guess the problem is the jury does not have the federal government sitting in front of it in the defendant's docket. It's got Whitey Bulger. So the jury has to render a decision on Whitey and not the
no,
FBI.
No, but Marjorie, come on. I mean, you've sat on it. Have you ever been on a jury, Adam?
Right, I have not. I've been called and then not have not served.
I have.
Well, Marjorie,
I'd love to.
And I have. And,
so,
and you
every
don't think
second.
Worst experience of my whole life, even though I'm glad I did. No, I'm glad I did it for the experience. You don't think that if that has an impact on even one juror, that one juror, even if they don't use the words, well, the government should be the defendant here, they start to argue, well, maybe let's find him guilty on the gun charges. Let's find him guilty on racketeering. But the reason he killed those people, again, I'm not saying that's going to be the outcome, but what else does Carney have in this case?
Well, I like the fact that he's pointing out the terrible corruption, because I think that is the takeaway from the whole Whitey Bulger trial, is that the FBI was corrupt for decades in Boston. It wasn't just John Connally. That's another bad thing. The only person that's paying a price for this is that one agent, John Connally. I mean, did anybody
we had
else?
Testimony from John Morris, who's, you know, reprehensible, Connally's former, at least titular supervisor, who got away with you know, not much more than a slap on the wrist,
right, exactly.
And now is getting, as they pointed out in the defense closing yesterday, a taxpayer-funded pension.
Yes, he is.
So, which is very disturbing. And it was interesting, in the prosecution's closing arguments, Fred Wyshak, who I thought, I hadn't always thought he was effective over the course of the trial. I thought that his close yesterday, especially the first half, was the best I'd seen him. He got very emotional when he was talking about Bulger's victims and the sort of human toll of his misdeeds over the years. But one of the arguments that he made, he said, don't get distracted by the defense pointing to, you know, all the horrible things that John Martorano did or Kevin Weeks did or Stephen Flemmi did. Yes, these are horrible people. But because they chose to cooperate with the government, we now know more than we would have known otherwise. You know, other people have been prosecuted and the families of the victims have received a measure of closure. He made a big point of saying, you know, if I were the family member of a victim, it would drive me crazy that John Martorano, you know, is a free man today, that he did 12 years in prison after killing 20 people. But it's not as bad as it would have been if he hadn't. But he also said, don't buy the defense's argument that corruption was endemic in the FBI or the Department of Justice. He actually called John Connally and John Morris a couple of bad apples. He used the phrase bad apples and scoffed at the suggestion that the corruption that enabled Bulger extended to the FBI in Washington, D.C. And he also scoffed at the idea that the organized crime strike force that was headed up by Jeremiah O'Sullivan before he became the U.S. attorney.
Who was the person who Bulger contends granted him
exactly,
immunity. He's dead.
Yes. He scoffed at the idea that there was corruption in the Department of Justice. Now, of course, he's a Department of Justice employee, so he's going to scoff at that. And I got to say, I'm not sure. It's hard for me, having sat through this trial for a couple months, it's hard for me to buy the idea that it was just a couple of bad apples in John Morris and John Connally who you know, on the part of the Boston FBI, let Bulger run amok. It's really difficult to buy the idea that it was that limited.
If you have questions about the trial, Adam's been there for much of it, 877-301-8970. Or if you have comments about what you, well, you haven't seen, of course, you haven't seen or heard, you've heard and seen Adam Riley. If you have comments about the trial and who wasn't on trial, namely the FBI, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. Here's a little soundbite. Obviously, we have no sound from the courtroom. Here's J.W. Carney after the defense lawyer, after his closing, assessing his performance in the closing arguments. Listen to him.
Didn't lay a glove on me. I wrote the chapter on the closing argument in the Mass Criminal Defense Treatise, so I think I know the limits that a lawyer can go.
I wrote the chapter on the closing argument in the Mass Criminal Defense Treatise. There's a guy who seems a bit piqued, I would say. In all fairness, because there's going to be a lot of criticism, assuming that Bulger is found guilty on virtually everything, there's going to be a lot of criticism, I think, of the lawyers. What did they have to go on? I mean, what are they going to do? They have a client who, it appears to us, and you've said this repeatedly, Adam, cared about two things, not being seen as a rat and not having killed Deborah Davis and Deborah Hussey.
I would just add one more thing. He wanted to show he didn't commit the murders that occurred in death penalty states of Roger Wheeler and John Callahan.
Well, that's very
in the World
interesting.
Affair,
he could still be tried. He could still be tried on those, could he not, in death penalty states?
I believe that in theory he could.
The trigger man in those cases was Martorano in the Florida case and the Oklahoma case. Who was the Oklahoma case killer?
I believe in both cases. And it's funny, after 2 months, a lot of this stuff is, I mean, there's
so many murders.
So much detail. And that's actually why I think so many murders. And that's why I think the jury is going to be out for a couple weeks and then come back and find Bulger guilty on almost every charge. But I believe Martorano, if my memory serves, I think he's copped to being the trigger man, both in John Callahan and the Roger Wheeler.
You know, I'm so glad you said just one thing. You know, the betting, I made a joke, but it wasn't really a joke. Everybody's betting about how fast the jury's going to come back. This notion they're going to be back in a nanosecond. We printed out this morning, Marjorie and I, the form the jurors have to fill out. It is endless. Count one, racketeering conspiracy. Count two, racketeering substantive offense. If you find James J. Bulger guilty as the count two, please indicate below which alleged racketeering acts you unanimously find the government has proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And then there are 33 of them. And then there's count four, three, four, or five, count through 26.
I mean, it's mind-numbing.
The bottom line, they have to answer every single one of these, and you can't just check the box. Unless you're grossly irresponsible unanimously, which they're not going to be,
yeah.
You have to actually have a discussion about each of these things.
If they do their job right, even if they're all, 99% of the way there to thinking that he's guilty on every count, it's going to take a long time to talk through this.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Adam Riley is here. He's covered a lot of the Whitey Bulger trial. If you have any questions for Adam, please call in. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. Christopher has emailed, wanted to know how much Senate President Billy Bulger, brother of Whitey Bulger, knew all these years, and was he in touch with Whitey in Santa Monica? I don't think we have any information that they were in touch in Santa Monica, do we?
We don't, but it would have been nice to have Billy Bulger, take the stand and be forced to answer some questions about his relationship with his brother, or at least put in a position where he had to take the fifth to avoid doing
as
that.
As he did in front of Congress.
And that's one of the things I got to say. This is the most time I've spent at one trial. I've been to others like the DeMacy trial and the Chuck Turner trial. I was at the Cahill trial some. But I haven't spent this much time at a trial before. And in a case like this, you want the trial to not just be a legal process that yields, a just ending, but you also want it to be sort of a cultural event that results in a full disclosure of everything that happened. I would have loved this trial to yield all the answers that we might have wanted to questions that hadn't been answered about Bulger and the things he did over the years. And it's really frustrating to realize that after 2 months, that's not going to happen. We're not going to hear what Billy Bulger might have to say. We're not going to see former U.S. Attorney and Governor Bill Weld take the stand and talk about whatever relationship he might have had with Bulger. This guy, Pat Nee, who was implicated or connected with a number of the murders that Bulger and his crew are accused of committing, and who for some reason has never been charged in connection with these murders, he walked into stand. His lawyer said he was going to take the fifth. Then he walked out, and he's starring in a Discovery Channel, reality TV show.
Disgraceful.
We still don't know. Pat Nee, many people think, was one of the trigger men when Bulger and perhaps Pat Nee killed Brian Halloran, the former FBI, or the FBI informant who they wanted to kill before he got them in trouble, and this innocent guy, Michael Donahue, who happened to have given him a ride home. But we're not going to learn who that second trigger man was. We're not going to know if it was Nee or someone else. So, it's maybe I just have sort of a naive, romantic notion of what trials can provide, but this is not a full accounting. We haven't heard from everyone we'd want to hear from.
Adam, we don't
know everything we'd like to.
I have the exact same feeling you do, and I always do, but the reality is one huge hole in almost every trial like this, forget Bill Bulger, is when the defendant doesn't testify.
Yes.
You don't hear from George Zimmerman.
I should have mentioned
in
that.
Florida,
yep.
Obviously, there's a huge hole left in a case, just like everybody
You're
was
exactly
anticipating
right.
the testimony from Whitey Bulger. Let's take a couple of calls. 877-301-8970. If you have questions about the trial or have comments about the last couple of months and have some expectation of what this jury is going to do and how fast they're going to do it, give us a buzz. How can Michael, you're in Framingham. You're next with Jim, Marjorie, and Adam Riley. Hey, Michael.
Good afternoon, all. How are you?
Great.
Hey, Michael.
So I realize the theatrics of all this, but at the end of the day, if we're actually looking at the rule of law and reasonable doubt, if I was a juror, not that I want the man to go free because I think he's guilty, but we're relying upon the testimony of known murderers who've gotten deals to get out of jail free, FBI people who clearly were working illegitimately or dishonestly. I don't know where you're going to grab onto something that's been testified to that's not hearsay or tainted by lies, and therefore, how do you grab onto it and say beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty? I mean, nobody's got a video of him shooting these people. I don't think that you have any. The witnesses that say that they were there are already convicted murderers and liars themselves.
Michael, that's a terrific point.
It's a great point.
I really think you nailed it. And that's, it's a point that the defense, as you'd expect, has been hammering home throughout the trial, pointing out that if you're John Martirano and if you've done a 12-year sentence after admitting to 20 murders, you have a big incentive to cooperate with the government and to testify in exactly the way that they want you to testify. And with Stephen Flemmy, one of the arguments that Jay Carney made for the defense in his part of the closing argument yesterday was that Stephen Fleming's serving a life sentence in prison right now, but it's reasonable to think that he may get some sort of a deal if his testimony helps to convict Bulger. So,
yeah, there's a big contrast. Michael, thanks for a great call. Anthony Cardinale, who obviously is the guy whose litigation in the late 90s broke this whole Bulger connection up, but he says that that Rule 35, which is the rule under which they cut these deals, you can only have one bite of the apple. However, based on the testimony that you described in the courtroom with Fleming, it suggests it is possible he's going to get another deal. And it seems to me it is so grossly unfair for a jury not to know that if I'm a juror, I say, well, Martorano killed 12 people or 20 people, got 12 years.
Right.
Weeks got was involved in the killing of five, did five years. Well, Fleming got a deal, but his only deal was not to be executed. Well, maybe he's in the midst of negotiating a deal, which is going to get him out of jail in 4 years.
Well, his
testimony, shouldn't the juror know that?
Well, I think they do, actually. I mean, Jay Carney was allowed to posit this as a scenario that jurors should be bearing in mind as they weighed the credibility of Fleming's testimony. So they do know that. And I know that Tony Cardinale says it's impossible. I also know that Fleming, when he was asked about this scenario in court, said, oh, yeah, everyone knows about Rule 35. And of course, it's something that my attorney would look at if it became possible down the line.
You know, by the way, one last thing about Michael from Framingham's great call. In one of the defense closings, this, I don't know which lawyer it was, he held up a sign or a placard with the printed testimony from Kevin Weeks, in which Weeks says, of course I'm a liar. I mean,
I've been lying my whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. You know, one little gruesome detail that I learned today, not to be too gruesome at lunchtime, but this is in Kevin Collins' column, speaking of people in jail, Catherine Grieg, who, of course, was traveling for all the years with Whitey Bulger on the lam and was a dental hygienist, Collins says that she gave Whitey the tooth extraction tools that Fleming and Weeks used to extract the teeth of the people they killed before they buried them.
She did.
Did he tell her why he was asking for these tooth extraction tools?
Do
we know that either?
My recollection is that we didn't learn that at the trial.
I don't think so.
Right. And it's funny how some of these details, you know, you hear about murder after murder after murder, and you start to get inured to the detail after a little while. You forget that you're talking about actual human lives and that there's a tremendous, you know, toll that's been taken by these killings. But every once in a while, when I was there, something would sneak up on me. And for me, it was the day that they were talking about the exhumation of some of these graves, some of the bodies that had been buried in secret graves by Bulger. And there was one body, and I can't remember which individuals it was, so I don't want to throw an incorrect name out there, but they talked about how the body had been buried near water and how when it was removed from the grave, the bones had the consistency of wet cardboard.
Yes.
And that was a detail that my recollection is that day, you know, my stomach was unsettled pretty much the entire day. And it was this stuff was incredibly macabre and very, very difficult to listen to.
Yeah, that's Adam Riley, our colleague at WGBH, who was in the courtroom for much of this trial. Before we get back to the calls, Adam, it was your tweet. You were one of the tweets on the, I think, opening argument that talked about my favorite juror, the sleeping juror.
Sleepy juror, yes.
So yesterday, everybody talked about how the prosecutor's argument was great, but too long. 3 hours and 15 minutes. Was the infamous juror awake for that one?
He looked pretty crisp. I mean, I confess that I did not watch him as closely as the trial came to a close as I did at the beginning when he, you know, was.
But he was awake for much of the trial.
But I may get in trouble for saying this on air, but I'm going to stick my neck out there anyway. It looked to me at a certain point yesterday as Fred Wyshak's closing argument for the prosecution stretched past the 3 hour mark, like the judge might be getting a little bit drowsy as he went on and on and on. I may be wrong about that. She may have been studying her notes intently, but he went on, and again, he was terrific at the outset, at the beginning, at the end, he had to rush through because he had stretched out.
You know, by the
way,
this is why we don't have cameras in the courtroom. Assuming you were right, and I don't want to belabor it because you say it's your that's one of the reasons. It's to protect judges, lawyers, whatever.
Yeah. Well, I feel
it's pathetic.
Having given Sleepy Juror a hard time, I should
and
say
we
that,
didn't even get to hear the voice of Whitey Bulger when he called this trial a sham. I mean, it's just disgraceful. Paul from Nahant, what do you think about the Whitey Bulger trial, Paul?
Hi. You know, given everyone's frustration at what will not come out at this trial, and believe me, what I want to hear about is Billy Bulger and William Weld. Given that these things are not going to come out, it just proves how dependent we are on having a healthy local investigative press.
Great point.
That is true.
And how much we should all pray for the successful transition of the Boston Globe.
Paul, we have bad connection, but thank you so much for the call. We'll pass along your feelings to Brian McGrory, the editor, when he joins us tomorrow. And the Boston Herald.
And don't forget
course,
the Boston Herald. We've done a lot of great stuff on Whitey Bulger over the years.
And the other great local outlets such as WGBH.
Yes, that's right.
And by the way, Gelsinis has written fabulous, a lifelong Southie resident. Peter Gelsinis has written great stuff in the Boston Herald.
And the connection between Whitey Bulger and Billy Bulger, who, of course, was the Senate president and one of the most powerful politicians in Boston and in Massachusetts the entire time his brother was running roughshod over South Boston.
Well, we should mention the Weld connection, since a couple of people have mentioned Weld was in the Justice Department during in a different division during this Jeremiah O'Sullivan dealing with Bulger. Weld, then the crime fighter in the Justice Department, becomes governor. And after excoriating, if I remember correctly, on campaigns, the brother of Whitey Bulger, he and Bill Bulger not only become best buddies, well, I don't mean best buddies, but best political buddies, he ends up appointing Bill Bulger to be the president of the University of Massachusetts.
And don't forget that scene where they sing Whitey on the MTA, right?
At the breakfast. Day breakfast. Yeah.
Do you know about the state trooper that was over at Logan Airport that was, do you know that story about the trooper at Logan Airport? Because this is a story about
Whitey
the direct
Bulger,
connection.
Yeah.
He stopped Whitey Bulger because Whitey Bulger was leaving the country with a lot of money. The trooper stopped him. What happened?
Well, you'll have to help me with the details. I mean, my recollection is that he was punished and that the evidence suggested that Bill Bulger was behind this punishment. Was it reassignment?
The allegation was that the state trooper at Logan Airport, and forgive me for forgetting his name.
Johnson, was that his name?
It might have been. Yeah. That he was demoted and kind of shunted aside within the Massachusetts State Police, and he ultimately committed suicide. And the allegation was that this was a payback by Billy Bulger for this trooper going after Whitey Bulger at the airport.
Does anybody have any doubt of that? I mean, of those in the know who were intimately involved in the lives of the mm-hmm. Bulgers over the last couple of years, journalists whom you respect, Marjorie, does anybody have any doubt
that his brother
had a hand in that?
There are stories in all these books. One was about a guy that was running for office over in South Boston being picked up in the car by Whitey Bulger and said, don't badmouth my brother Billy.
Right.
And the guy stopped badmouthing brother Billy at the instructions of Whitey.
Joe Malone, who was the treasurer, had been treasurer a few months, former treasurer of Massachusetts, with us a couple of weeks ago, mentioned either here or on my television show, Whitey Bulger won the lottery shortly after Malone takes over. He tries to withhold the money. He gets a call from somebody on Bill Bulger's staff essentially saying, you don't mess with these people. This is a guy on Bill Bulger's staff calling the sitting treasurer. I mean,
it's unbelievable, and it's such a huge part of the story, as you said, and the fact that the government made a few points of getting Bill Bulger's name in the trial, but he was never really a focus. And the fact that he wasn't a focus of the trial, again, just shows how ultimately limited this was, not just as a legal process, but as a historical reckoning. It didn't do everything we wanted.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Andre. You're in Marlboro. You're on with Adam Riley. We're talking, obviously, about the Bulger trial as the jury takes up the case. Hey there.
I just had a question. Do you think that the FBI created an invincibility type factor for like Bulger or Fleming and these guys because they basically knew what they were doing? And I think these guys kind of grew a sense of like, entitlement, like, we can do what we want because we got FBI basically, backing us up in a way because they knew what they were doing, but they didn't really press the issue so much.
By the way, the trooper's name was William Johnson.
Yeah, I just looked it up.
Sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead, Adam. I'm sorry.
I think the caller's exactly right. And in fact, I don't even think that the prosecution would argue with that characterization. The only difference between the prosecution and the defense on how much the FBI enabled Bulger and his associates would be how many people in the FBI were on board. The defense would say it went right up to the top. The prosecution would say, oh, it was John Morris and John Connolly. But yeah, absolutely. I think the FBI was key in terms of giving them a sense that they could act with impunity.
You just mentioned this trooper, William Johnson. In his obituary, it said that he was embittered by a demotion from the narcotics squad at Logan to a job patrolling a parking garage. And the trooper left explicit directions that he wanted no Massachusetts state trooper in uniform at his funeral. And his sister said the state police veteran, former Green Beret from Revere, never recovered from the direction his career took after a chance encounter with Whitey Bulger.
How heartbreaking is that story?
Heartbreaking.
You know, Adam, we only have a minute left. What was this like being in the courtroom? I mean, this is this mythical guy who was never going to be captured. Then he's captured. Well, he's never going to be tried. And then he's tried. What was it like being in the courtroom in the physical presence of Bulger and Martirano and all these other characters?
Well, I think I mentioned to you before that you want these people to look as evil as they are. And you expect them to sort of be palpably terrifying, and they're not anymore. You know, they're old guys who have, you know, they're no longer in their prime. They're no longer the threat they used to be. And it's
weren't you the one who told us when some old guy stumbles into the courtroom, no one knew who he was. He's in a windbreaker.
Yeah, that was
and
Flemmy.
It was Flemmy who came into
the courtroom. And I remember walking into court and thinking, who's that old dude standing up by the witness box? And then realizing a few minutes later, oh yeah, that's Stephen Flemmy, the mass murderer. So, you know, it was very surreal in that sense. And I would also add that there were times in court where you found yourself laughing at, say, a quip that a witness like Flemmy might make. And then, or at least where I found myself chuckling at something that one of these witnesses would do. And then being mortified that I was laughing, you know, finding anything humorous about anything they were saying. And based on, you know, I'm pretty comfortable saying I wasn't the only member of the media who experienced this. And I don't know what to chalk it up to. Maybe it's the fact that as they you know are today, it's so difficult to imagine that they did the things they're accused of doing. Or maybe it's just that when you hear about things like bones with the consistency of wet cardboard being pulled from the ground, you look for relief in places that it might be inappropriate. But that was always something I was a little uncomfortable with. You know, when I'd find something moderately amusing and then be aghast at myself.
Well, proof that you're not alone. How about when Flemmy and he were throwing F-bombs at each other?
Yeah.
Everybody was not in the courtroom alone. Everybody was laughing about these two old guys and former comrades.
It's true.
Throwing F bombs.
Well,
at
I think you're right, Adam. It's comic relief. You needed some kind of comic relief, even though it may have been, you know, not totally appropriate. You know, Paul has a question. What's your last name, Adam?
My last name is Riley.
Riley. My last name is Egan. Paul wants to know why we in the press played down that this is the Irish Mafia. Why not tell the truth that the Irish Mafia locally was far more deadly locally than the Italian Mafia ever was? Do you think we've played that down? We haven't really said that much about the Irish Mafia, have we?
I don't feel like I have. I mean, if asked to contrast the lethality of the the Mafia and the Winter Hill Gang, I think I would give the edge to the Winter Hill Gang, absolutely, by a wide margin. That said, and I'm not trying to get into like an ethnic back and forth here, but two of the mass murderers who testified for the government were named Flemmy and Martirano. So it was an equal opportunity, sort of a rainbow coalition of psychopaths.
Okay.
Adam Riley, you and Philip Martin, you did great work
great
on this
stuff.
Trial. I'm sure we'll talk to you when
Thanks,
the jury
guys.
Comes in.
Appreciate
Thanks so
it.
Much for your time.
Adam Riley is a reporter for WGBH. You can catch him with us on 89.7 and also on WGBH-TV and Greater Boston. That's on at Channel 2. Emily's show is every night at 7 o'clock, and Adam's a frequent guest. So maybe Whitey and his crew wouldn't have gotten away with so much crime if the MBTA police and their 2D technology had been used to track the Winter Hill Gang. We'll elaborate on this premise next, 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You know, there are never enough cops around to please everybody. So in tight budget times and in the wake of the marathon, camera surveillance is expanding. But on the T, there's a new idea, a cardboard cutout of a police officer. Here to explain is Deputy Chief of the MBTA Police, Robert Lenihan. Deputy Lenihan, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you today.
Hi, Deputy. Thank you for coming to talk with us. So you've got a bike theft problem over there at the Alewife MBTA station. What are you guys doing about this?
Well, it's actually the Alewife T station is an anomaly amongst the entire T system anyways, in that it's not only the largest parking garage for automobiles, but it's also the single largest location for the parking of bicycles. It's not unusual that the demand for bicycles to be parked there is so large that there could be almost 2,000 bicycles parked at that station on an average business day this time of year. So with the popularity of all the bicycles being parked there comes the associated crimes of people coming to to try to steal them. So it's been a long-term problem there, and we've tried other operations in the past using plainclothes officers, putting decoy bikes out and waiting to observe, as well as trying to heighten the public's awareness through the giving them literature on better ways to lock their bikes, or even just encouraging them to register their bikes with us. And we actually take a digital photograph of their bicycle so that, God forbid, it is stolen. We have an actual photograph of the bike we're looking for and trying to recover it.
Yeah, but Deputy, what is the idea that is actually doing the trick?
Well, it's funny. It's a combination of a bunch of things. Over the long term, what we did was we actually stationed an officer at Alewife Station a year ago, and that's actually had a good impact on driving down the theft of bikes over the long term. But what happened was the district commander for that area remembered reading some articles. If you can remember back, when the HOV lanes opened, there were people getting citations because they put a mannequin in the car.
Yes,
sure, blow-up
yes.
dolls.
Right. I did that a couple of times, actually, myself.
All right, we'll see if we can mail you a citation.
Okay.
But in addition to that, mostly on the West Coast, to try to curb speeding there, there's actually been life-size cutouts of officers with radar guns put on the side of the road to try to slow down cars. So the commander for the area took that basic idea and took the idea of, what if I take a life-size cutout of one of my officers and post it inside the bike cage, almost like an omnipresent police officer there watching over the bikes? And that experiment's been in place now for just about 5 weeks, and it's had a more dramatic short-term drop in the amount of stolen bikes in the area than the full-time officer assigned there for the entire year.
The associate, you're being a little modest. The Associated Press says that it has cut bike thefts in that five-week period by 67%, by two-thirds?
That's probably, once again, being polite. We're tracking the two bike cages there for stolen bikes because that's where we have the images of the officers.
Mm-hmm.
And from those two bike cages, which are very secure anyways, they have an access control, just like a college dormitory with a Prox card. There's chain-link fence surrounding them. There's surveillance cameras within, and in spite of all that, in the period of July 5th to August 4th of 2012, people were still able to steal six bikes out of those cages last year at Alewife Station. This year, with the cutouts in place, there's only been one bike stolen, and that was a bike that was actually stolen there for an extended period of time, and somebody actually cut part of the fencing to be able to get the bike out.
Hey, Deputy Lenihan, let me tell you, well, posted on our website at WGBHnews.org is a photograph of the officer. I believe his name is David Silent. And
yes.
If I saw a photograph of Officer Silent, I wouldn't steal a bike either. He's a big boy. How
big
did you
guy.
Choose that particular officer?
Well, it's funny. Before my promotion, I was actually the commander of that area, and I can tell you that out of all the officers assigned there, he is significantly the largest officer there. Now,
did you hurt his feelings?
As we're paramilitary, I'm not sure whether the officer actually volunteered or his commander volunteered him for the project. But he does create an imposing image there. He probably would not be voted upon as an officer friendly, somebody I'm going to approach to ask for directions.
How actually big is he, Deputy Lenihan? How tall? How much does he weigh?
Officer Stylin is probably about 6'2", 6'3", and suffice it to say, he probably weighs in excess of 250 pounds.
Yeah. I would say that.
No, he's a formidable guy, and it's a formidable picture. And I can see why people look at this deputy and think twice about stealing a bike, because, as you said, they're only looking for a second. But, you know, I was just thinking about this story. You know how everybody hates Canada geese, and especially they get all over their lawns
and
all that.
In Cambridge, in particular.
And so, you know, we put out these fake dogs and these fake coyotes. But the Canada geese are too smart to be fooled by the fake dogs and fake coyotes. Is this a bad sign that thieves are fooled by
humans.
The fake officer? What do you think?
What we think is that it's having two effects. One is that the cutout is actually larger than the officer, if you can believe that. So it's visible from a distance. So I think what's happening is that some would-be thieves are seeing it at a distance and then just being dissuaded from even going over to that location because they can see a cop off in the distance. But I also think there's a psychological impact that even if they come over there and are intent on stealing a bike, that it's still burning on their head. You know, there's a cop staring at me that even though I'm convinced it's a board, how do I know that they're not watching, you know, through the cop's eyes, watching what I do? So I think there's a psychological impact on the on the thieves also.
You know, Deputy Robert Lenihan, last question for me. I love this, and obviously it's great that it's working, and it's, according to, again, the Associated Press, saving as much as $200,000 a year, which is another great thing.
Yes, sir.
But the thing I worry about, I hate the term, but I can't think of a better one, is the slippery slope thing, is in a time of limited resources, is there an attraction to say, well, listen, we can't have enough transit officers on the T itself, so maybe we'll put one of these flat things in between trains. And, you know, the great thing is it may scare off thieves, but the bad thing is somebody who actually thinks they're being protected by a real human being, when they find out it's a cutout, I mean, it's potentially scary. Are we going down this route, or is this a one and out kind of thing?
Well, I don't think it's a slippery slope, but what I think it is that in its certain circumstances, certain applications, it has a very large source. We'll retape this. I think in certain applications, we could do a lot of good with this.
Yeah.
Not just in stolen bikes, but in a lot of the other
like what else?
Type issues that we deal with here. We are inundated daily, weekly, monthly, yearly with complaints about fare evasion in locations, as well as smoking in different T stations. Mm. And my thought is that using this experiment, that we then multiply it by taking some of the high incident areas where we get a lot of these complaints, and I'm not saying deploying it, you know, a cutout of an officer there for months on end, but getting in there for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And because once again, you know, we have a cutout, say, at Malden Station for 3 days, and then he's gone, and then a week later, we actually have a cop standing there.
That's
and
great.
We may actually be dealing with somebody who says, oh, it's just a cutout, and they'll do something stupid, and we'll actually apprehend somebody in the act of doing something.
So I think that's a great idea, the occasional cutout pop-up kind of deal. Mm, they pop
correct.
Up and they disappear. Deputy, one last thing. Have you had any reports of anyone trying to engage the cutout in conversation over there in Alewife or not?
No, but right now it's funny. The people who normally park there, it's a quick glance. I think they almost feel reassured seeing the cutout of the officer there.
Yeah.
I would. So last thing from me, Deputy, what response have you gotten from the two-dimensional Patrolman's Benevolent Association? What have they what have they said about this?
Well, actually, we were doing fine with that association until I actually was asked to put a cost estimate on what it was saving us, and they're now asking for a new collective bargaining agreement.
Hey, Deputy Lenihan, you were great to give us a few minutes. Congratulations on this innovation. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye now.
So the question is quite simple. Do you like the idea of the cutout cop? And give us examples, the Deputy Lenihan did too, of other potential applications. But also, if you share the worry that I do in time of cost cutting, I'm serious, they're going to put a flat cop in a lot of places where you need a real cop. I mean, Marjorie, that's why they have cameras. They're cheaper.
I know.
And there are lots of eyes, even though it's hard to argue. This thing, if you do go to WGBHnews.org, the photo will be up of Officer Sillen, who is as his boss said,
figure.
He's an imposing figure. 877-301-8970. What do you think of the idea? And again, if there are other creative applications, I thought his idea of having them try to scare potential fare jumpers is a great idea. You have a few days of a flat cop, then you have a day or two of a real cop, and then I'm serious, then you go back and forth. And you know what I also love? Where did the idea come from? It came from the fact that when the HOV lanes were created on 93, a lot of people were using inflatable dolls.
They were.
So they had a second person in the car so they could do this. 877-301-8970. Knowing you as I do, Marjorie, you love the idea, right?
Well, I do love the idea. I think it could be a cost cutting kind of thing. Christopher wants to know. Art wants to know, do these cops get prevailing wages like flaggers? Do they get overtime if you forget to replace them at the end of the shift? How can you tell when they're asleep? And what does it mean when a cardboard cutout is more effective at crime than live police officers?
877-301-8970. Let's start in Rhode Island, or in a second we will start in Rhode Island. With Barbara. Are we ready for her? We will be in a second. Barbara, hi, how are you? Welcome to Boston Public Radio. What do you think, Barbara?
Well, I just want to see a little videotape from the security cameras where the cardboard cops are on guard. I just want to see pictures of people doing the double take.
You mean they go up to Officer Sillen's cardboard cutout and say, Officer, can you tell me how to get to Central Square? And
anything.
The officer doesn't...
Great on film.
That'd be great. A little candid camera. Barbara, thank you so much for the call.
I think it's very distressing that the thieves are fooled by the cardboard cops.
That is a great
point. And the Canada geese are not fooled by the various decoys many of us have tried to put. I mean, you guys, it's famous over there in Cambridge.
It's huge.
You have an infestation of the Canada geese right by the bridge there, right? Which bridge is that?
Magazine Beach. Can I tell you something? When I was on the Cambridge City Council,
mm-hmm. the glory
I would
days.
Say about 50% of the public comment was in defense of the, quote, living room, as they called it, of the Canada geese.
Yeah, well,
down there on
they're,
the,
very, they're just messy. They're very
they
messy.
Are, and, they're, well, and they're also vicious. They are really vicious. Let's go to Hannah. You're on the road, and you're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. I'm so happy I got through.
Thank you.
I just had a little story. I was actually in Thailand over the summer, mm-hmm. And on their sort of like two-lane highways that they have problems speeding, they dress up mannequins in full cop uniforms, and they put them like under a little umbrella because the sun is so hot.
Oh.
And you see them from a distance, and even if you're like, "That's probably a mannequin," you know, you don't want to risk it. So
it's brilliant. Now, by the way, that is
yeah.
Yeah, obviously
That's
everybody
great.
Slows down.
And it's three dimensional, so they should maybe upgrade the cardboard to a little dressed up mannequin.
Well, yeah, that is the next. Hannah, thanks for a great call. That's a great. I mean, why a flat cop? Why not do a mannequin, dress them up, and looks even more real? By the way, that's a brilliant, what Hannah just said, that's a brilliant use. We're talking about applications. There's no harm in that at all.
Why
have them
there?
Stationed on the turnpike.
Have little fake, little 3D little patrol cars. The state troopers out, you know, every 5 miles or so on the Mass Pike or 93 North, a little fake car, little fake trooper, or big fake trooper, and I think your speeding problem, Jim, is solved.
You know what one of the most intimidating things is? It happened yesterday morning when I was driving down Soldiers Field Road to the station here. When those real cops, even on a road like Soldiers Field, which where was the speed limit 35 miles an mm-hmm. hour or something, are pointing that radar gun at you, isn't that a frightening thing?
I find any time I see a police officer,
it's a frightening thing.
I immediately
thing.
Feel guilty. You know, what have I done wrong? I mean, even if I'm not doing anything wrong, is my inspection, you know, is it going to stop me because my bumper is in bad shape? I mean, I worry all the time about police officers
you know what happens
pulling me
when,
over.
When they implement Hannah's idea here from Thailand to Greater Boston, and all of a sudden there are a plethora of flat cops, and obviously you start ignoring them after day three, and then you realize the flat cop turns into a real cop.
Well, that's why.
Like the guy said, like
Deputy
Lenahan
said.
His
idea was brilliant. You had to fool people. You just keep moving around. One day it's a flat cop. One day it's a field cop. I mean, a real cop. Keep everybody guessing, back and forth.
You know what? Speaking of what I mentioned before about the Canada geese, the Cambridge City Council, mm-hmm. half of my colleagues could have been flat city councilors. No, I'm serious. And they never would have. In any case, George, you're a Marblehead. You're on with Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. Hey there, George.
Hi, George.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Fine, great. Thanks.
Hey, you know, it's just a matter of a couple of days before people start drawing mustaches on him and poking holes in his eyes and all kinds of things. Right? You know, that doesn't work for very long. But here's what I do. I've
what?
Got a teenage daughter, 16 years old, just turned 16, started driving. I got a cardboard cutout of myself that I put in the back seat. You know, not only for the texting, but for the boys. You know, and I made it so that I can actually sit behind it. So, you know, that makes one move, I grab him from behind. You know?
George, you got a great business
that's
idea
great.
There. Thanks for the call.
I love it. Green on the road. What do you think about the flat cop protecting all the bicycles from thievery?
Well, you've just told everybody, so how's it going to work? Everybody knows now.
No, but Corrine, if you listen carefully to Deputy Lenahan, what they do, and I think they did, he said they did this earlier at the cages where the bikes are, where there's a lot of thefts at Alewife T-Stop, but I know he said they were doing it at the turnstiles. I don't
right.
know if they're called turnstiles anymore.
Right,
a
right.
few days of a cutout cop, then a few days of a real cop, and you go back and forth, so they keep you guessing. So if they're careful yeah. about it, you can't really predict.
I don't know. I don't think it's
going to
work, but nice try.
It is a nice try.
Thank you, Corrine. Let's
I just
go.
Don't want to see. My concern, I really
what's,
don't
what's
want to
concern,
see.
What's your concern, Jim?
It's one thing, you know, if your resources are such, you save $200,000 because you can't mm-hmm. afford a new cop, you don't want to see them ultimately deciding that there are more places where there are real police officers now where we can put a cardboard cutout and spend money on cameras
yes,
or something.
Yes, we used to fight about this on the police detail front because there are police details everywhere in Massachusetts. Governor Deval Patrick says he's implemented a flagger program to cut down the expense of those details. I have never seen a flagger. He says they're there. I think we could do,
do you know if you go to the DOT
flat details.
Do you know if you go to the DOT, the Department of Transportation mm-hmm. website, it's like dot,
yeah,
dot.
You get a map.
There's a map where you can see where the actual flaggers
yeah, that's right.
are.
Have you ever seen one in person, Jim?
Let's take a call.
Okay.
Jim from Rhode
Jim
Island.
Jim from Rhode Island. What do you think, Jim, about the flat cop?
How are you guys doing? First time, long time. Love you guys.
Thank you.
You.
But but I think we could probably expand this to maybe healthcare with Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
and we could see our cardboard cut out of a physician.
I hope it's not going to be that bad.
It's one way to cut costs. You have to agree to that, Jim, yes?
All right. Thank you, guys, very
much.
Thank
you. Thank you for your call. Let's do one more quick one. Jay in the truck, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jay.
How's it going?
Great.
Great.
Good. It kind of reminded me of World War II, D-Day, Normandy, when Marjorie mentioned making, like, inflatable or cardboard states. It was how the U.S. Army, they created an entire fake army on one side of the English Channel. Like hundreds of inflatable tanks and inflatable trucks and cardboard cutouts and all that to make the Germans think that they were going to attack.
As a decoy, you're saying, right?
Yeah, exactly. So to make them the Germans think that they were going to attack further up the English Channel and not on Omaha and all that.
Wow. I didn't even know that.
The history of the inflatable here on Boston Public Radio. Jay, thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate it.
Okay. When we come back, when it comes to Boston bombings, local hospitals, everybody knows this, got unanimous praise, deserve unanimous praise for how they triaged and treated the victims of the Marathon explosions. But there's still room for improvement, and that conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH at Boston Public Radio. Stay tuned. Oh, we're going to talk to the doctor from the Brigham and Women's. Whoops, I goofed that up a little bit. Sorry about that. The doctor from the Brigham and Women's up next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm James Edwards. I live here in Brighton, and I report here in Boston. Well, I do this because of the accountability.
The chamber's salary is far and away the highest in the state. And I would say that one of the reasons for that is that it is the largest, probably most complex, urbanized environment in the state that has a city manager form of government.
Me sticking with journalism is sort of the work and kind of that sense of public good in a way. James Edwards, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum in Lincoln, Mass. 30 acres of contemporary art set in an idyllic outdoor landscape, plus constantly changing exhibitions in the galleries. Open every day this summer. DeCordova.org. And New England College of Business and Finance. NECB offers special benefits for employees of its corporate partners. You can learn more about the benefits of the NECB Corporate Partnership Program at necb.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. One of the upsides, if you can call it that, of the Boston bombings was that our local trauma centers were subjected to a major stress test, a test they passed with flying colors. Not one patient died after reaching a hospital. That said, medical professionals say there's still lessons to learn and improvements that need to be made. Joining us online is Dr. Eric Gorolnik. He's the medical director of Gillette Stadium and medical director of emergency preparedness at Brigham and Women's Hospital. In response to treating the bombing victims, just a couple of days after, Dr. Gorolnik told USA Today, quote, "I realize that I'm doing the right thing and I chose the right profession. I'm doing what I wanted to do, and that's to help others. All this is, though this is a horrible situation, that was where I found comfort." Joining us in line is Dr. Gorolnik. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning, sir.
Hi, morning, Dr. Gorolnik. Thanks for joining us. So, doctor, as Jim just said, not one patient died after reaching a Boston hospital, which to me, a layperson, seems absolutely amazing and incredible, and credit to you guys. What do you want to improve?
Well, we need to do our due diligence and look at the many lessons learned from this experience. The successes were really based on the long-standing efforts of collaboration, working across our disciplines, across hospitals, law enforcement, fire, EMS, and we've worked together as a team for many, many years. So now we need to really delve in, and as we've done, beginning that night, beginning that day, begin to work together to build on these lessons learned.
Dr. Gorolnik, I want to get into some of the details of what that building means, but can we go back to April 15th? My recollection is, I read, you were at the PRU, were you not, when you first heard about this? Is that correct?
That's correct. I was at what I believe is now Boston Sports Club, which was the Fit Corps at the base of the Pru. We run a clinic for our Team Stork, formerly the Team Brigham runners. There are about 150 runners from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Mass General. And we run a clinic there that typically will deal with dehydration, blisters, et cetera. And I was at the base of the Pru in the Fit Corps there when several individuals just came running in to the Fit Corps itself, yelling and screaming. And one person said that there was a shooting. So from that point, I put on my backpack with my gear that I prepared for that day and the treatment of patients. I was there with three nurses and eventually a resident in our emergency medicine residency program that had shown up. And I went to security in the Prudential Center, and they directed me via eventually a Boston Police Department gentleman, and he brought me down to Boylston and went to the site. And actually, by the time that I got down there, most of the patients had already been evacuated and taken to the hospitals. And then from that point, there was another, essentially the policeman grabbed me and said that there's possibly another device. So we ran back through the Pru, found some leadership through the police department. The three nurses, the resident, I got an ambulance, and we went back to the hospital and then assumed our responsibilities in the response.
And you know, the Globe story, Liz Kowalczyk wrote in the Globe last week, said there were 19 patients brought to your emergency room in 30 minutes. But just staying at the finish line in that environment, to take nothing away from the brilliant work that was done at the six trauma centers, including yours, Dr. Goralnik, had there not been a huge planned presence of medical personnel, not to mention medical-related personnel who were running the race or watching the race or something, it's unlikely that this perfect record of not one person dying when once they reached a hospital, it's not likely that would have been that good, correct?
This is a planned disaster. The marathon is a planned disaster every year on Patriots Day. July 4th is a planned disaster here in Boston. And what I mean by that is we work together across all those services we mentioned earlier and have, in fact, for the marathon, we have a 100-page document that's issued by the Boston Athletic Association in conjunction with the city that describes in detail the protocols that we need to follow in a response in any sort of event that might occur during the marathon.
But the reality is, I guess what I'm asking is the physical presence of all these trained people
at the medical tent.
At the tent and people who were watching the race. Obviously, that had a huge impact on the outcomes in emergency rooms, did it not?
There's no question that that response was tremendous. The fact that we had a really robust presence with EMS personnel, with volunteer physicians, nurses at the finish line along the 26 miles of the marathon, but particularly there with the medical tents and bystanders who contributed, bystanders who are veterans who had seen these types of injuries before. That combination really contributed so significantly to our response.
We're speaking with Dr. Eric Goralnik. He's the medical director of emergency preparedness at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he was on the scene at the Pru, as you just said, and also later at the emergency room at the Brigham on the day of the marathon. So, doctor, I've read a lot about this, what you are planning, that there's a concern about identification and other things. So what do you want to improve? What are the hospitals looking to do after lessons learned at the marathon?
Well, we've come together as a community, and the Level 1 trauma centers, in addition to the Boston Children's Hospital and some of the community hospitals, we've come together in a series of debriefs, in addition to the other providers, EMS, fire, and shared lessons learned across these organizations. And clearly, some key points and some themes that are not just as a result of the marathon, but many of these disasters are, number one, communications. Both internally and externally, thinking about our response specific to our emergency department and communications between staff members with regard to patient status, their disposition is an opportunity for us to improve on. Externally, across organizations during a disaster, we really had tremendous support from Boston's emergency management group in addition to EMS, They did a remarkable disbursement of patients evenly across the hospitals, but there's opportunities to improve with that. And then more specifically to your question, Marjorie, with regard to information systems, this was a challenge across all the various hospitals within Boston. We utilize information systems for many of our much of our clinical care. And so there's an opportunity to take a look when we get 19 patients in half an hour. How do we respond? How do we register patients? How do we perform orders? How do we track those patients throughout our system? So that day in particular, from lessons learned from Colorado in July of 2012, we learned that we potentially could get 23 patients.
The shooting, exactly. In Aurora, okay.
That's right. So we took a look at that. Our former vice chairman is now the chairman there at University of Colorado, and we worked with him shortly after that incident and got a lot of feedback. And that's what we do, is we study these lessons learned from other experiences. So we went in thinking that we potentially could get 23 patients within half an hour, and we built our system around that. So we prepared with preparing pre-printed packets for patients and registering them in the system. But there's opportunities to improve on how we did that and how we executed that day.
You know, the whole ID issue, and for I wasn't aware of this, but it's pretty obvious until I read the Globe story. Obviously, after that kind of situation, people don't come in with IDs or wallets. They're, the most horrible ID problem told in the Globe is that Crystal Campbell, at least Crystal Campbell, who obviously we all know was killed on Marathon Day, a friend of hers ended up with her ID, her handbag, and the people at MGH, Mass General, thought they had Crystal Campbell there alive, and needless to say, they were wrong. You said in the Globe story that you had some near misses at Brigham and Women's too. Describe, obviously without names, describe to us what you encountered, Dr. Granick.
Well, again, Jim, if we got 19 patients in half an hour in an already busy emergency department. At 2:49 that day in a 55-bed emergency department, we had 66 patients, including patients in hallways. So one of our first things that we needed to do was rapidly decant or move patients from the emergency department upstairs. So you can imagine face-to-face sign-offs with many of those patients either being discharged or brought upstairs, and then an influx of 19 patients, and then subsequent waves of patients, a total of 39 patients, which inundates our registration system. So we had initially registered these patients, and we had to go back around and reevaluate them, re-ID them, work with the patients that were awake and alert. Obviously, we could get their IDs in a pretty rapid fashion, but others we had to work with various services to try to identify those patients in a rapid fashion to prevent mix-ups of lab work, mix-ups of radiology readings, mix-up of patients going to the operating room. So when I use the term near miss, these are all opportunities for improvement. And we made an effort by July 4th to rectify those systems. So we've redone, for example, our naming convention at the hospital to make it much clearer and succinct. When you're viewing our screen that tracks our patients, you can very clearly determine which patients are where and what their temporary names are.
Okay, it's time for a couple of stupid questions, Dr. Goralnik, from me. You know, I understand ID internally, because obviously you want to know which patient you're treating and in what fashion. But obviously the second issue vis-a-vis identification is family members, loved ones, that sort of thing. Sure. When someone comes in with no ID and they're not conscious, or at least they're not able to communicate, how do you figure out who Jane Doe or John Doe actually is so you can communicate with people who are connected to them?
So what we would do, in this case, the city was very responsive and the Department of Public Health was very responsive, and we worked with them to reunite families and patients. We wait and work with our public affairs unit to identify patients via family members if they don't have an ID. So we need a face-to-face identification.
Oh, you mean that somebody says that my husband, I can't find my husband,
yeah,
and then essentially they get to what, look at photographs? Or what? How do they, if you have five unidentified, hypothetically, unidentified patients on a day like that, how does the husband, wife who can't find the husband, how do they get to identify the man they're married to? How's that mechanically work?
So essentially we work, I refer that to the our public affairs office, and they work with the families in addition to our patient family relations, and they're in charge of that role. I primarily take care of the patients.
You know what I wondered, doctor, too, about not having IDs? I mean, every time you go to the doctor, it's, you know, what are your medications, and if your surgery, when did you last eat, and all these kinds of things. So when you have people and you don't know, are they diabetic? You don't know if they just ate three cheeseburgers. I mean, how do you compensate for that when you're taking people? That obviously affects what you do tremendously, right?
Yeah, and that's not just a challenge during the marathon, right? This is sometimes a challenge when somebody's in a car accident, they come from the scene, and we don't have appropriate identification or a shooting. So this is a challenge, and our primary job is to treat the patient initially and resuscitate them. And we try to find out as much information as possible, and usually EMS is very good at providing us information from the scene and any pertinent details, and we do our best to work with our resources to identify them as quickly as possible.
Dr. Gronick, let me go back in time to something you said, to Marjorie a couple of minutes ago, and if I get the numbers wrong, I know you'll correct me, that your training was such that you had the capacity to deal with 23 patients in a 30 coming to the emergency room within 30 minutes. Is that what you said?
That's correct. We based that on Colorado.
Okay. Now, the thing that I find hard, I'm trying to think about in my work life, trainings I've had through the years about hypothetical situations and my mindset, and obviously I'm not a medical person, and more often than not, while I took it seriously, in part of my head I'm saying to myself, this is never going to happen. There's never going to be X or Y emergency that I'm going to have to use this, so I half pay attention. When you're doing this kind of training, despite what's happened in some of these, you say Colorado, obviously, and Connecticut and places like that, isn't it hard to get people focused on the possibility that a day like Marathon Day can actually happen until it does?
It's very challenging. You know, this is the long haul. There's sort of the pre-event, the event, and the post-event. The pre-event is typically the longest part, right? We've been training for these events since 2002. Really since 9/11, mm-hmm. focused on these type of events. So to keep people focused with all of their other priorities is difficult. And that's why taking the step and doing dedicated training, really walking individuals through what they need to do, and taking a few minutes at regular intervals seems to be much more powerful and effective than reading something on the web,
sure.
or other modalities.
Doctor, one last question for me. I assume, again, as a layperson, that the big thing about the kind of injuries you were seeing in the marathon with the loss of limbs and so forth was the blood, getting people blood, which you can't do in the ambulance, correct? You have to wait till you get to Mass General or the Brigham or Beth Israel to restore that blood, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So that was the fact that you guys were close enough was a huge thing.
Well, there's no doubt. Time is very powerful in trauma resuscitations. We talk about the golden hour, getting patients seen and evaluated and dispositioned in a very rapid fashion. And so it was very important, again, to your point earlier, Jim, in your question, the fact that we had amassed this robust response, individuals pre-positioned. The streets were effectively closed so we could get ambulances mm-hmm. in there in a rapid fashion, were directed to the hospitals. That was really critical to getting patients evaluated and resuscitated in a prompt fashion.
Dr. Eric Aralnik, congratulations to you and your team, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, sir, ma'am.
Thank you very much, doctor. Dr. Gronick is the medical director, Gillette Stadium, and medical director of emergency preparedness at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And thanks again, doctor, for being with us. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about hospitals and how they're run and how safe they are or not with Charlie Baker, who used to run Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. Open mic is next on Boston Public Radio. This is 89.7 WGBH.
Millennials. They have different tastes, and car companies are just trying to keep up.
You hear Fiesta, Party, and Versa being a typical Nissan fake word implying versatile. All of these get at the same idea, which is that they're practical but fun.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, the subcompact generation. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Northeastern University, where researchers are engineering new construction materials and methods to build 21st century sustainable cities. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And the Westin Copley Place. You can relax in their newly renovated guest rooms or dine on fresh local seafood at Turner Fisheries Restaurant. More information at turnersboston.com and westincopleyplaceboston.com/SIC.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Charlie Baker's a former candidate for governor. But more importantly, today, he's the former head of Harvard Pilgrim. Last week, we talked with Charlie about Consumer Reports' first ever ranking of surgical outcomes of America's hospitals. Some local big names didn't fare so well. Well, we started a discussion with Charlie about the value of the information to consumers, at which point he asked for more time to consider the issue. We granted it. Back today, hopefully with homework in tow, is Charlie Baker. Hey, Charlie.
Good afternoon, guys, and I really do appreciate the fact that you granted me more time. I mean, that sounds like the kind of thing that, you know, grand poobahs do, you know?
Well,
you are thereby granted an extra day.
That's exactly what it was, Charlie.
It's like the Princess Bride, you know, when Red Pirate Roberts used to say to Wesley, really good job today, Wesley, maybe I'll kill you in the morning. You know?
Have fun storming the castle.
Exactly.
Charlie, you know that Jim is a grand poobah, isn't
you.
He?
I do.
He is a grand poobah, that's right.
So what's the deal? Was Consumer Reports right about some of our most esteemed hospitals in Boston not having the best surgical outcomes that we all thought they did, or was their data flawed? What do you think?
All right, so I actually think, for those in your listening audience who want to take the shortcut out of this, I actually think the little article that the Globe wrote on 7/31/13, which was their white coat note on this, Consumer Report releases the ratings, I think this does as good a job of describing both sides of this issue as you're going to find anywhere. And the long and the short of it is, Consumer Reports acknowledges that their data isn't perfect, but they also say it's probably as good and as comprehensive as it's going to get using the publicly available data sources that exist. And if the hospital industry, which uses a variety of other means and mechanisms to collect and measure performance and quality, doesn't like what Consumer Reports put out there, then maybe they should start to make some of the data that they collect that they say refutes the Consumer Reports information public. And I think that in some respects is part of what's going on here. I mean, you guys both know that I've been on this transparency kick since, you know, 2004. I think it's one of the major, I think it's probably the biggest problem. Well, we have a lot of issues in healthcare, but I think it's definitely one of the biggest ones, that there's so little publicly available information that people agree on. And if what Consumer Reports is really trying to do here is be provocative and make a case based on the best data that is publicly available and sort of drive a conversation that brings other people in the healthcare world into that conversation, I'm all for it. And I read a lot of the stuff they developed about which sources they used, how they adjusted for, you know, the severity of the patients that were being treated and all the rest. And frankly, it's pretty comprehensive, and I would argue, you know, at first glance, it's not perfect, but it's definitely not, this isn't, you know, sort of ragtime. They put some serious work and effort into this and took pains to make adjustments where they thought they should make them.
So, Charlie, you're a person, forget an emergency for a minute where you don't have time to make a decision.
Yeah, that was a fascinating conversation, by the way.
Which was?
The one you guys just had.
Dr. Goralnik.
From the Brigham. Yeah.
Well, they did insanely wonderful work, six trauma centers.
Kidding.
But
right.
But putting that aside, forget the emergency where you don't have time to make a decision. You're about to have a surgical procedure. You read this survey. It's one where you can make a considered choice. Essentially, what this is saying, I mean, the headline, is in certain things, one of the most famous hospitals in the world, Mass General, for example, is not where you should go, and Kearney Hospital is one where you should. That's essentially, by confirming their research, you're saying that's the decision you should make in certain cases, right?
I guess I would say, Jim, is my big conclusion from all this is actually less about what it says about the academic medical centers and more what it says about the community hospitals. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of my conclusions from looking through all this and reviewing the information is that the community hospitals are better than they get given credit for when it comes to this kind of measurement, when it comes to measuring things like complications, when it comes to measuring adverse events, when it comes to measuring, you know, bed sores, central line infections, punctures and cuts during surgeries, which are all the things they use to measure here. You know, my conclusion from this is community hospital. Part of the reason that's my conclusion is because it sort of fits with my own view of the world, which is that I think community hospitals historically have gotten kind of a bum rap, and mm-hmm. I think they're better than they get credit for, and better in some cases than their brand. And I think one of the things this report says is that based on these measures, they probably are better than sort of the conventional wisdom on them. And I think that's a perfectly fine place to start the conversation. But if you were to sort of take the next step and say, does this mean that all these wonderful institutions that perform so heroically on the day of the marathon, are somehow, you know, lacking? My answer to that would be, you know, no. But what it does mean is there's probably places where they can get better, too.
Well, you know what?
But the big message here is the community folks, I think, are better than we've given them credit for.
You know what one of the classic things is, Charlie, mm-hmm. that I think where transparency is so lacking and would make such a difference in people's lives? Having babies. Most women having babies are very healthy. They're young women. They expect everything to be fine. And you sort of, you know, if you're going to a hospital that's 30 miles south of Boston or west of Boston or something, you have friends that are saying, what are you doing? Go to Mass General, go to the Brigham, go to Beth Israel, which is kind of crazy because you have to be driving all that way in labor. But there's this idea that that's where you get the best, you know, and I'm sure they do have the best neonatal nurseries and all that kind of stuff. But thank God most people don't need neonatal nurseries. They just want to have a baby. And there's this pressure. You know what I mean?
Yeah, although my view on this stuff always comes back to, this is patient-doctor relationship stuff. I mean, I think most people most of the time will make a decision on big issues like this based on conversations they have with their treating physician about what it makes sense for them to do, and I think that's as it should be. But I also think we ought to put more data into the public domain around performance so that the doctor and the patient can be better informed than they would be otherwise. And I think the larger point that Consumer Reports makes, especially in this little article in the Globe from the end of July, is that if the hospitals don't like the methodology, which is very comprehensive and well-considered, because Consumer Reports is a class operation put together, then instead of just saying they don't like it, they need to come up with one that they do like, and they need to make it publicly available.
Hey, Charlie,
engage the debate.
Let me finish this part of our conversation with the same question I asked you when I was chairing a panel that you were on when you were head of Harvard Pilgrim maybe 6 or 7 years ago. The same question I asked you last week. I am as pro-transparency, I think, as you are, particularly in this area. The more information, the better. But the question I asked you was this. When you are making a decision that is as intimate and emotional and personal as a healthcare choice, and I don't mean something minor, but something more than minor, what evidence is there that the consumer has the ability to make choices based upon information that you and your former colleagues provide for them? The example I gave was when we all were so excited when the telephone industry was deregulated X number of years ago. We all got these phone calls. We had no idea who to choose, and we were in angst over that. At least I was. How can you make an informed decision here?
Yeah, I guess what I would say, Jim, is two things. Number one, for me, game here has always been less about that and more about just sort of the public and the urgency and pressure that transparency would create within the provider community. Remember, here we're talking about people who overwhelmingly have never gotten anything less than an A in anything they've ever done. I mean, let's not forget that most of the people who go into medicine are playing, you know, at the top of the charts in sort of all things scientific, academic, you know, knowledge, intelligence, the works. And I think a more public vetting of performance would actually encourage them to either get better at the things that they're not as good at as their peers, or they would simply stop doing them, which overall, even if no one changed anything about what they decided at a at an individual level would give us a safer and more more effective healthcare delivery system. And in addition to that, I guess I'm very much of the mind, Jim, that if you choose not to access the data, just talk to your doc. It'd be great if your doc had access to that data so they could help you make a decision. And for those people who really want to get deep into it, I think it should be available to them. Let's face it, as you pointed out, these are among the most important decisions you make in your whole life.
Fair enough. I'm there.
Let's move on to something else that's sort of depressing, I think, for the whole state, and not just if you're a Republican. Piece in the Globe about the tiny Republican caucus. I'm going to quote Michael Levinson. The tiny Republican caucus in Massachusetts, in the Massachusetts State Senate, which could fit comfortably in a compact car, is getting even smaller. We just had a state senator resign. He's going to take a job at Westfield State University, leaving just three Republicans.
Out of 40.
Out of 40 in the upper chamber, the Senate chamber on Beacon Hill. Senator Bob Hedlund said, it's pretty treacherous territory, and it's kind of ridiculous, actually. It really is, Charlie. Like I said, even if you're not a Republican, if you just want a balance in Massachusetts, it's getting out of control.
Well, here's my attempt to put the positive spin on all this.
Okay.
Because right? That's kind of what I'm supposed to do here.
I want to write this down. Go speak slowly, please.
Most of the time, the people who end up running for and getting elected to the Senate were members of the House, okay?
Right.
I mean, that's been the historical pattern here. Well, we have twice as many Republicans in the House now as we had 4 years ago.
That's true.
So the party has made, and we, by the way, we also have a lot more elected officials at the municipal level, which is usually where people run and get elected before they run to serve in the House. So, yeah, well, this is not a pretty picture at this point in time. I actually, I think the kinds of things you have to do to build the infrastructure that eventually leads to people's ability to get to know the district well enough, and for the people in the district to get to know them well enough for them to succeed running at the Senate level, has actually gotten better over the last couple of years. And I think the fact that Don Humminson, who is one of those Republican state reps in Mike Canapic's district, who's the state senator who just left, has declared that he's running for that seat is an example of what I'm talking about. And we also, by the way, we win the quality battle over the quantity battle big time, in my opinion, in the Senate. I mean, Hedlund is very much his own person. So is Bruce. And I think
Bruce Tarr.
Some respects, Richard is also. And they both, all three of them represent what I would describe as sort of, politically middle-of-the-road type districts, and they're all very popular in their districts. So
Richard Ross, we should say, is the third you mentioned. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I did mention Richard, right?
No, you mentioned his first name. I thought, Charlie, also, since you're putting a positive spin on this, and since I so agree with you on transparency.
It's kind of my job, Jim.
No, let me put a positive spin on it, too. The fact that the whole Republican Senate delegation can go around the state in a Mini Cooper is also... It's going to be good for the environment, correct?
We are the carbon free delegation in the Senate. That's exactly
okay,
right.
Charlie. One more political thing. It's August, and we're sick of your dilly dallying. Now, did you read David Bernstein's piece in the Boston Magazine about his predictions for 2014?
No, what did he say?
Yes, you did. He said
I didn't. I've been traveling.
Okay, fine. He said essentially that I'm paraphrasing. If he had to predict, he would say the next governor of the Commonwealth is Charlie Baker. Now, in light of that fact, he tweeted us a couple of minutes ago and asked if we would ask you if you have anything to say about filming a web announcement in the recent past or in the immediate future. Is anything happening on that front, Charlie Baker, please?
I'm spending most of my time, as you know these days,
we do.
Running around in the, state of Louisiana and Texas working on my business stuff. And I told everybody, including you and David, actually, at one point, that the Bakers know they need to make a decision by Labor Day, and that's our plan.
So what's the answer to the web thing? Have you filmed anything, or is there a script? Is anything in the works on that front?
There's nothing out of the ordinary going on with respect to any of that stuff.
That was the most hesitant answer you've ever given.
Well, I was just trying to process it. Okay.
So
we can't yet. So essentially, what you're saying is you have not yet made an announcement, but there will be one either way by Labor Day. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think we should make that announcement here, Charlie Baker. I'm just saying. Just saying.
What's so funny about that? We assume you're going to make the
announcement. Nothing is funny about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, you were just speaking about, or Jim was speaking about, the entire all the members of the state Senate that are Republicans being able to travel on the state in a Mini Cooper. You know, you're the carbon-free group.
That's a good line. Yeah.
Speaking of being a carbon-free, you know, all this meat production takes an awful lot of energy, causes pollution, climate change, deforestation, blah, 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 blah. Did you hear about this $300,000 hamburger, which came out of a Petri dish and was made out of, grown in vitro from cattle stem cells? What do you think about that, Charlie? What do you think? A little in vitro stem cell hamburger? What do you think?
That's just one more great reason for why my daughter, who's a vegetarian, probably has the right idea with respect to some of this stuff. I have not heard of that one.
It's new.
The fact that it's $300,000 probably makes me think it's a long way from anything, on some level, thankfully, that we'll ever have to worry about.
They said it's about 20 years. You'll be starting your fourth term by then, Charlie, you know?
Yeah, very funny guy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Charlie Baker, it's a joy as always, and thanks for your work on the, serious, on the hospital survey thing. We'll talk to you next Tuesday, Charlie.
Okay, take care.
Thanks.
And how right is he, Charlie Baker? We do need that kind of transparency.
No, by the way, that is huge. And by
incredible.
The way, he made a very good point that even if the public is not ready to use it as diligently as I'd like and as I'm sure he'd like, it does have great potential to improve the quality of care. I agree with
him. Okay, Charlie Baker does join us every Tuesday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, I can't wait for this, Open Mic with Brian McRoy from the Boston Globe. Boston Globe, of course, has just been bought by John Henry, owner of the Red Sox. And the Washington Post has just been bought by the owner of Amazon. It's the Amazon guy,
Amazon,
right?
Amazon, yep. Chuck Bezos.
The man behind Google Glass has made, that hamburger I just talked about, it's his new contribution to society, the $300,000 test tube burger. What do you think? Ready to try one? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Each day, All Things Considered brings you unparalleled insight into the latest news. We interview experts who have deep knowledge on topics of the day, who have the skills to explain. We unravel complex issues that sometimes seem too hard to grasp. I'm Melissa Block. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News, your appointment with excellence.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the law firm of Wolfe Greenfield. Specializing in intellectual property law, Wolfe Greenfield provides clients with solutions on patents, trademarks, licensing, and litigation. WolfGreenfield.com. And Boston Children's Hospital. With suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close at hand. Boston Children's Hospital. Until every child is well.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And as Marjorie just mentioned to Charlie Baker, the most expensive burger ever made was served in London yesterday. This is true. Research and development costs around $300,000. Now, the good news for animal activists and cows is that it was made in a test tube. The downside was that even the creator said it didn't taste that good. So the question is, would you eat a test tube burger if you knew it was helping to save forests and cattle? Our number is 877-301-8970. Now, he did say, as I mentioned to Charlie a minute ago, that it's going to take 20 years till this is on supermarket shelves and affordable. I have to say, the whole concept to me, and maybe I'll feel differently in a year, is so nauseating.
Oh, please.
And by the way, I don't like cruelty to animals, and I don't like – there are a lot of things that trouble me about eating meat, which I do a lot, probably to excess. But eating a test tube burger – is one of the least appealing things I've ever heard.
Listen to the description. Okay, it does look like a red meat patty, but it's knitted together with 20,000 strands of laboratory grown protein combined with other ingredients like salt, breadcrumbs, and egg powder, and then they add red beet juice and saffron for color.
I love saffron.
And it tastes like animal protein cake, the testers said, who were reserved in their judgment of the taste. Quahavi. The best we get out of this is a very good start, said the scientist who created it. I mean, quit eating meat. That would be my advice. If you're worried about the pollution problems and you're worried about the cattle and you're worried about the energy, the deforestation, the biodiversity, et cetera, I mean, this is just disgusting. A test tube, I mean, it's made out of cattle stem cells.
Yeah, but so they're cattle connected.
Growing in the Petri dish.
Well, there's that. Is it Petri or Petri?
That's Petri, Petri, whatever
it
is. I don't
know what it is. 877-301-8970. Apparently the vote in the studio is 2-0 against the $250,000 burger. But you know what it is? It's one of these things where ultimately when they improve the taste, which even the creator acknowledges they got to do, and they bring down the cost from the $332,000 that this one did, ultimately I guarantee you, I say it is quite likely in a decade, this is what people are going to be eating. Did you see? I didn't know the number. Listen to this. The meat industry contributes about 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
That.
I mean, that's huge. That's almost one out of five, you know, almost 20%.
Do we decide if it's McPetri or McPetri?
It's not Mick either.
Well, it is, because from Mark, he just emailed. What he said he can't wait for one of these burgers, a McPetri dish sandwich. Or is it Petri? Is it a McPetri
whatever
dish
it is,
sandwich?
It's not...
Whatever it is. That's right. You could also argue that probably how much different does it taste than the McDonald's burgers, which lots of people don't think are very good. I suppose if you put enough ketchup and mustard and relish...
Most people don't think are really good. Do you know how many they sell every
single
day?
I know, but they're not very good. They're not very good.
Are you kidding me?
Hamburgers from McDonald's?
Oh, man. Let me tell you, when you can get one of those babies in a drive-thru, it doesn't get much better than that. 877-301-8970. There's a test tube burger. It was unveiled, I guess you'd say, for lack of a better expression, yesterday in London. I think it was yesterday. It was yesterday, the day before. It cost $332,000 to develop, essentially. And the guy behind this admits the taste needs improving, and to get it to the shelves, to get it to supermarket shelves will take roughly... somewhere in the neighborhood of two decades.
877-301-8970 or bpr@wgbh.org. Are you ready to try one of these little babies? Barbara from Wrentham, what do you think?
Well, the first thing I think is, ew, how disgusting.
Yeah.
And then the second thing I think is, you know, I like an occasional hamburger. I like salmon burgers, too. I like chicken burgers. But the thing is, like, maybe in the future I won't be able to get the regular hamburger. But tofu's good, too. So are legumes. And all of those things have been around for centuries. And who knows how this thing will affect me health-wise.
You make a very good point, by the way. I had about a year ago, because we were discussing it on the air in our former radio lives, I had one of those vegan hamburgers. I know it's oxymoronic, but one of those things. And I have to admit that other than the consistency, which is a huge part to me of whether food tastes and feels good, it was close. It was not quite there. It was close. So I guess the notion is if that's close, then ultimately they'll get this to a point where it's close. But Barbara, isn't the concept also important? The fact that it comes from a cow's stem cells and not from cow meat? Is that not troubling you or no?
I would rather eat walnuts or cashew, anything else for protein if I'm going to have a high-fat meal. And the whole idea of from stem cells, it's just something about it makes me feel it's really dangerous. I don't want it. I just don't want it. It's just repulsive.
Barbara, thanks for the call. The ew is pretty much my reaction as well, at least my initial one.
Steven says that eating one of those ew burgers can get you suspended from Major League Baseball.
Yeah, it probably can. Let's go to Gabe. You're in Milford. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the test tube burger unveiled in London yesterday. Gabe, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to say I'd love to try a test tube burger. I'll tell you what, though, I'm not a vegetarian in the slightest. Like, all the things that have to do with slaughterhouses, they don't really bug me. But when you really think about it, how could something made in a lab be any more disgusting than what's produced out of these slaughterhouses?
That is a wonderful and sad point, Gabe.
I suppose that's true. And there's no fat in it either. And that's the other thing. I mean,
isn't fat where the taste comes from?
Exactly. That's what I was saying. How can it taste good?
Isn't Gabe, that's a good point.
Isn't that the beauty of the cheeseburger when you
go to the store? Well, I assume they add something.
Do you get the 80% fat hamburger? Do you get the 85%? Do you get the extra lean at 95%? What do you get, Jim?
I do the 85. I mean, I know what you think. You think I do the 50-50 is what you're probably thinking.
No, I thought maybe you were doing the 90 or the 95 lean.
I sometimes go for the 87.5. I do a mix. But, you know, The notion, they're ultimately going to deal with texture. They're obviously ultimately going to deal with taste. It's more, with me, I think it's more conceptual. I mean, it's totally good for the environment. It's obviously, you have a horrible look on your face.
I just don't like meat enough to go through this for. Remember, give me a piece of chicken. You know
when
I mean?
this guy called a minute ago and said, how much worse can it be than the stuff that's produced at a slaughterhouse? Remember when Johnny Carson, the best host of The Tonight Show ever, was sued by the meat industry? Remember what he had said?
What?
I don't know if they have them anymore at McDonald's. They would say like 10 billion sold in the arches, 100 billion sold. And so I don't remember what the exact number was. And Johnny Carson's doing a monologue. You can see it on YouTube. I actually saw it a few months ago. And he says something like, we have to congratulate McDonald's. Do you see the new sign? They sold 100 billion hamburgers. And he pauses and he says, I don't know. That's got to be at least a quarter pound of meat. And I think that's the perception of, was it Gabe who called a minute ago from Milford?
Edward has just emailed in.
What did he say?
He said it could be Petri or Petri.
Isn't that interesting?
Thank you, Edward.
How do you know that he knows what he's talking
about? I don't
know,
but I can't pronounce anything, so what else is new?
Melanie, you're in Londonderry, New Hampshire, and you're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for your call.
How you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for your call. As I said, go.
Okay. Well, I think it's a fantastic idea, and I think it's going to be, great once they actually come to fruition. Personally, I've always been, a humanitarian and really, I love animals in general and not humanitarian, obviously, in a sense that I eat humans, but I think if we were to, weigh out the, I'm not a vegetarian, unfortunately, because I'm an O negative blood type. I don't know if you guys knew about the AB. If you're AB or any of the derivatives, you can actually be vegetarian and get away with it a lot better than someone with an O.
I did not know that either.
Yeah. So, I mean, this option for someone like me, throw some Worcestershire sauce on there, you're good.
But how do you feel about Whole Foods has started doing this where they have the list of how humanely the meat you're about to be buying was treated before it became the meat you're about to buy?
Is that the number system?
Yeah, the number system. So you feel – pardon me?
It's horrifying. I mean, not with the Petri situation, like what they're trying to create.
Right.
But, what they do to the animals, Like I said, if I could be vegetarian and get away with it and not, pass out at work, I totally would,
Yeah.
Hey, thank you for your call, Melanie. Remember when Temple Grandin was in here, who obviously has done brilliant research on, it sounds oxymoronic too, on humane slaughtering of cattle. I mean, it doesn't deal with the environmental impact, but in terms of the cruelty to animals thing, which is a lot of the reason why a significant number of people have become vegetarians, she thinks she's created a humane, again, poor choice of words, a humane way of slaughtering cows.
Well, they don't know what's hit them.
I guess that's,
Yeah, it's sort of, they're not the mooing that you hear when they're getting pushed up the railings altogether. And they have the whole thing with the chickens, right? The free-range chickens or the chickens that have been, they're not stuffed into these little chicken houses where they're so squished together, little feet.
Oh, their feet don't even touch the ground.
Touch the
ground. Just so horrible.
Oh, I know. I hate that.
This is a topic for another day, and we'll get back to your calls in about 10 seconds. When you see those kind of movies or read those kind of books, don't you say immediately, how can I possibly continue to eat chicken or beef or pork or what? It's pathetic that people. I mean, it is pathetic.
Yeah.
I'm talking, looking at myself,
oh,
not
yeah.
you.
You have to go back to your granola for like 2 weeks. But that's why I was so happy when they did this thing where you could know the status of your animal while still alive. And also, chicken that's stuffed together in little cages tastes and looks different than the chicken that you get because it's the runoff is different. It's clearer from the free range chicken, and it's not as yellow, as greasy as the ones that are overstuffed. The chickens are. They're made to eat really quickly so that they get fat fast.
Oh, that's what they mean when they say, do you want stuffed chicken? Is that what? 877-301-8970. Let's go back to the phones. Drew, you would be in Worcester, and now you're on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Drew.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
I am thrilled about this burger. I've been a vegan for about 15 years now and a member of part of the animal movement for 10 years or so.
Yep.
And I'm hearing all these responses, and I got to think, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on here. People are disgusted by a clean, lab-grown burger, but what about the dead body? What about the animal that was exploited and that
lived
a terrible life, the blood, all of that stuff? Why are people disgusted by the clean, new, scientific thing when in reality, for a long time, we've been abusing and mutilating animals.
No, you're
totally right.
You're right.
Cheap as a burger.
Drew, let me ask you something, though. What is your favorite vegan dessert? Do you have any recommendations?
For sure. Massachusetts has so many vegan things. You wouldn't believe it. It's right below the surface. In Boston and Alston, there's a vegan ice cream place. It's phenomenal. Right next door is another all-vegan.
You can say the name.
Yeah,
what's the
called?
Name of the ice
what's
cream
called?
Joint?
Sure. The ice cream place is called FOMU in Alston. And right a couple doors down is Root, which is a local vegan restaurant. All the food is sourced from local stuff. And then right next to that, there's the vegan Chinese place. Three vegan places
wow.
in a row in Boston.
By the way,
wow.
I should say, in Cambridge, Drew, in Central Square, the single busiest restaurant, and there appear to be dozens, is a vegan place at the corner of Inman and Mass Ave is huge. But Drew, following up on what Marjorie said, every once in a while,
sure.
I dip my toe in vegan water. I will, and it's always a dessert. It's usually from Whole Foods. I have the best of intentions for all of the reasons you mentioned so wisely a couple of minutes ago.
Uh-huh.
I have huge, we have to do this as a separate topic soon. I have huge problems with the taste transition.
That's why I asked him.
How long does it take? And you can't deny that there's taste shock initially. How long does it take to get over that when you're transitioning from traditional eating to veganism?
It's a good question. And I mean, in reality, if we were talking about becoming vegan in the 90s, when I became a vegan,
yeah.
I would say it's a little bit tough. But nowadays, you go to like any supermarket and there's mock meats, there's vegan cheese, there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, you might be surprised that some of the stuff that you get at restaurants is actually vegan. You might not know it. They might already be using some alternatives. But I don't think it's all that difficult. In fact, at the numbers of vegans that are going up, especially among young people, it's like
it's huge.
It's
yeah.
nuts. I mean,
hey,
under
Drew,
18, it's like 10-15% of the population.
No, it's huge. And Drew, thanks for the call. You know, before the summer's over, we're going to do a show
on vegan
with
carrot
experts.
Cake?
No, not vegan carrot.
Well, they have carrot cake.
Veganism in general,
yeah,
and whether or not
cake,
the transition.
Taste. The same.
No, it doesn't quite
no.
do it, but
the
maybe
cream cheese is not.
But
cream
Drew
cheese.
Sounded terrific. He
sounded
alive,
sounded healthy,
healthy, exuberant.
Absolutely. Josh from Brighton, what do you think about the test tube burger, Josh?
Hi, Marjorie. I'm very excited. Although I have to say that what they did there was a really good way to ruin a burger.
What'd they
oh,
do?
Yeah?
Well, they fried it in oil and butter. When was the last time you ever put a burger on a frying pan and put some cooking oil on that?
That's a fine point. Do you know that to be a fact? Because I read the Reuters story. I didn't see the cooking method. Is that really how they cooked it?
I had read okay. somewhere online about that, and it just seemed to be, aside from it being a very non-American way to make what is essentially American food, you know, sometime, you know, I don't think they were getting, you know, they were getting butter flavor or some kind of other oil in there, and that's just not right. So I'm excited about it. Give it some time. Wait till they can, you know, cure the fat or whatever they can put in there, and I think we'll save some methane emissions.
Okay.
Hey, Josh, here. Thank you for your call. You know, I have to say the last several calls were pretty powerful, and it really is true. How short-sighted are you and I? We're upset by the fact that they're making a burger out of stem cells of cattle, but we're not upset by the way they slaughter cattle
oh,
so we can get a hamburger that pleases our senses.
It's a very good point.
In any case, we really promise you we will do a vegan hour on the show here before
that's
all
right.
this is over.
That's what I want to know, the best vegan carrot cake and chocolate cake. Meantime, what does it take to free yourself, listen to this, from a lattice of chains, from a regulation straitjacket, all while underwater? An escape artist based in Medway says it's all about thinking outside the box, literally and figuratively. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
China has a new protection for its aging population, a law requiring adult children to look after their parents. Elder neglect is a hot topic in China.
And there was this one outrageous story of a farmer who kept his 100-year-old mother in a pigsty with a 450-pound sow.
Ooh. The Chinese-American journalist tells how the law affects her own family next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988. Located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at GroganCO.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. You know, voter turnout, we talked a lot about this, for the special Senate election was dismal. Clearly, a lot of Bay Staters didn't do their civic duty. But did you redeem yourself by casting a vote for Alexandria the Great? Alex Purnell is an escape artist extraordinaire who recently appeared. In fact, here's the cheering you'll hear at the end of her performance. Listen, who recently appeared on America's Got Talent. She's here with her, appeared to me, fairly nervous husband, Bill. Alex and Bill, it's great to see you both.
Yeah. Thanks for having
me. No wonder he's nervous. I've been nervous every single second of the day. Alex, tell people who didn't get to see what you did on America's Got Talent. I mean, this is just extraordinary. Tell people.
Well, the act that I just completed was actually one of a kind. It's the first time it was ever done, ever. I have an underwater cell, which we call UC, because you can see everything. And what I did was I took two of Houdini's greatest escapes, his straitjacket escape and his water, his milk can escape. And so I was in my water cell. I had 25 feet of chain, 5 padlocks, on top of a regulation straitjacket. I went underwater. I had to hold my breath. And they locked the lid, so I had to get out of the chains, the straitjacket, and then pick the lock on the outside of the lid.
Oh my God!
And get out. And
I don't
that's
want to
what
do,
I did.
I don't want to be disrespectful. I did that this weekend.
You
Alex.
Did. You did.
I mean,
how did
not,
you do?
It's not that big a deal.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay. So how long did it take you to do that?
Well, the unfortunate thing with America's Got Talent, if you know anything, they give you 90 seconds.
Yeah.
So that's kind of for everything. So I did it in a minute and 10 seconds. So
wow. So you beat the clock.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Now, you just before we get back to America's Got Talent, you've got children, right? You've got two daughters. Bill's over here. You're the husband. I mean, I used to watch, as I told you, Tony Curtis and Houdini right. When I was a little girl. I had a heart attack just watching him on television. Something could happen to the mother of your children over here, Bill.
You know, we obviously do everything we can from a training perspective to keep her as safe as possible. You know, we like to say she doesn't have a death wish, she has a life wish. But, you know, we think that there's a lot of symbolism in what she does. And in terms of getting out of your box. And that's what literally she did the other night. And for her to kind of do this, you know, we obviously made sure that we had the best training in the world. David Blaine did an underwater escape. We went to the same free diving group, performance free diving, to be able to get her ready for this. So before I allow any of this stuff to happen, because you know what? That's the love of my life. She's my junior prom date. We've been doing this since we were kids.
Yeah.
Before we leave you, though, I'm watching you during, I don't know, one of your performances. I'm not sure which it was, your wife's performances. You're smiling. You're looking totally relaxed through maybe the first 50 seconds. I may be off a little.
Yeah, okay.
But I wouldn't say your anxiety level, your concern level is growing as the clock is moving. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what are you thinking at that particular time?
You know, we train and we practice. I can read her like a book. So we've got this kind of nonverbal communication that we can do. And I feel comfortable at about 45 seconds, 50 seconds. After that, I know it's touch and go. And that's where, you know, I'm rooting for her. You heard a cackle in the back. That was me. I was just so excited that she got out. And, you know, every time she gets out, I feel like I got out. You know, it's like, oh, my God, thank God she's out.
You know, you're sort of Grandma Moses-esque from what I read. I mean, not no, I mean,
about?
In terms of your talent,
Audrey,
how old were you?
Yeah,
how old were you when you started? I mean, I know you did this when a kid, but when you started doing it professionally, you were not a kid anymore. How old
no,
were you?
No, actually, I started my very first escape, miraculously was called the Underwater Leap of Faith, which truly it was for me, was 2009. So I was 47 when I did this.
47. So you start.
But you did this as a little girl and kept it a secret.
Right. So, I hid it. I was in my box.
So what does this mean? You were in the pool in the backyard or at the lake in the pond climbing a lot of things when you were a little girl?
Well, I had a pool growing up. And, you know, when Bill and I met, I always had a love for magic. But when we were growing up in the 70s, you know, we had Doug Henning and David Blaine and David Copperfield. And they would do all these shows. And that's what I would see. So I would see them, you know, they would start with the cups and balls and linking rings. And then they would go on to an illusion. And then they would end with a beautiful Houdini-like escape. And very challenging, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to start there.
You know, by the way, as I'm looking to Alexandria the Great, Alex Purnell, as she's talking to Marjorie, what's the necklace you're wearing there, Alex? Could you describe that
well,
to the listeners?
This is my lock that my husband gave me when I very first went on stage in 2009. So it's kind of like my lucky charm.
So how old are your kids?
I actually have three.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. I have a 22-year-old daughter, I have a 19-year-old daughter, and I have a 15-year-old son. And my 22-year-old daughter has a 9-month-old baby boy.
Congratulations, Grandma. So I was right when I said Grandma. Right. When your teenagers call you on the phone after they hear this and say, or if they haven't already, hey, Mom, I'm thinking of becoming an escape artist when I grow up. We'll ask your husband to say, what do you say to them?
Well, you know, I'd probably say, are you sure? And let's arm you with the right tools. You know, we at our house, my son's a goalie, so we always talk about, you know, tools in your toolbox. And
do you get
you know,
scared when you're, I have to yeah, say, I'm know. Watching this and I am I'm hyperventilating.
Scared. So tell us what it's like to be under the water in the straitjacket with all the locks and padlocks.
The thing that people don't understand, because they see the whole thing and then they see it, me get out, but everything has an element of uncertainty. So the chains, I mean, we can practice all we want, but sometimes every single time we do it, the chaining is different. I've had times when I've been practicing this and because there's buckles in the back of the straitjacket that the chains have literally gotten caught on the back of the straitjacket.
What happens? Does someone come rescue you? What happens?
No, that's when I use my mind over matter, and if it doesn't mind to me, I do whatever I have to get out. And so it's perseverance. It's a challenge. And at the end of the day, I know I have three kids that I need to get home for, and I will do any means necessary to get out.
Well, how long can someone live without breathing? About 2 minutes.
Seems to know. What's the answer?
With freediving, I mean, and that's why we've really wanted to arm her with something, something real. Some freediving, the women's record for a breath hold is 8 minutes.
8 minutes,
It's amazing what you can do. But that said, that's a static breath hold. That's the old dead man's float where you don't move.
When you're not trying to rescue yourself from a straitjacket and chains.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, panic is it will take your breath away just like that.
Okay.
And so anything happens wrong, you really have to have the mental fortitude to be able to kind of push through. She trains. We train worst case scenario. And so that, you know, she deals with contractions. She can do up to 52 contractions. And that's your body saying, hey, you need to breathe. She can ignore that.
What are contractions? You mean like breathing?
Yeah.
Like
if you start to run out of air,
your
body will kind of start to kickstart it and go like that.
So, we're talking to Alex Purnell, Alexandria the Great, who just did this remarkable thing on America's Got Talent and does it in lots of places. And her husband, Bill.
And Howard Stern loved you.
Well, let's hear Mandel and Howard Stern. I've never heard Howard Stern say anything good about anybody except a naked woman. Here are the Howards.
This was like the best escape artist that I have seen.
Oh, thank you.
I think Houdini has been reincarnated.
Thank you.
He said he was going to come back.
Well, you know.
Harry! Harry! Is that you? Anyway, Howard, what'd you think?
Home run, A+. This is a tough thing to pull off, and you pulled it off.
You had to think that there's no way Howard Stern's going to say anything good at all about a middle-aged woman. Is that not a – no matter what you did, right?
That was always in the back of my mind. To be honest, you know, I thought about doing this last season, and then we heard Howard was going to be the judge, and I'm not a size 2. That was a box that I had myself in, and I just didn't think that he would – understand what I was doing. And
he was effusive. He was so into it.
Oh my God. He's been my biggest supporter in this whole thing. And, you know, I mean, I love him. Love him for it.
So, Alice, let's get back to this being underwater and something goes wrong. Now, if something goes wrong, do you, Bill, say, okay, after 2 minutes, we got to pull her up? Or because you're not going to let your wife die down there.
So, do you want to know a secret? If everybody can kind of keep a secret out there?
Sure.
Okay. So, Alex's secret is when she's in trouble. Yeah, and
what do you do?
I stick out my tongue.
Really?
Well, because it's the only part on me that isn't flailing.
Oh, okay.
So he knows that if I stick out my tongue, if I look at him and I stick out my tongue, then something's wrong.
Has that happened?
Yes.
And what was the circumstance?
Probably the underwater cell is probably the beginning of that. It's probably the best story you can tell.
Okay.
On that one.
When we first Franklin Glass built me this underwater cell. It's made of Lexan, so it's bulletproof, shatterproof, cannot break it to get out. So when we first got it, we decided to do a dry run. Well, the dry run meant that we were going to fill it with water. I was going to go in, and then I was going to get out. And neither Bill and I are science majors. So we didn't realize we had the lid open and we filled it. Well, we didn't realize that you need to have the lid on and, you know, the way you want it in the end when you're filling it up. So we had filled it up and everything else. And so then when I went in, held my breath, Bill put the lid down and he had to kind of pull the lid a little bit in order to, it had shifted to put it, to lock it. And so he had difficulty doing that, which we figured no big deal. Well, then I gave him the sign, the thumbs up, like, okay, I need to get out. He couldn't open the lid. So
it was the worst feeling in the world. And what it was we didn't realize she had a wetsuit on when she was doing it. And she was pushing up against it. And we had the lock in the front of it. So it was bound. And I didn't know that. We were in our garage. I had to run from my garage into the house to try to get a snorkel because I couldn't figure out how to open it up. She had to be under at least 3.5, maybe 4 minutes. And she hung on. So that free diving, which a lot of people say is dangerous or looks dangerous, you know, it saved her life.
Oh my God!
That was probably the worst.
So how do you concoct these terribly creative things, escapes, performances? Where do they come from? Your head, the two of your heads? Well, I'm serious. How do you do this?
We do it as a combination. I do like to pay homage to Houdini because he is my idol. But the one thing, if you know anything about Houdini, is he didn't like people that copied him. And I do believe that if he was here today, he wouldn't be doing what he did, you know, 80 mm-hmm. years ago. So what we do is we do research. We look and we see what's out there and how can we give it the Alexandria the Great twist. You know?
So, I mean, obviously you just did this on America's The Talent Show, but where else do you do this? Are there places people can go see you perform this?
I would love, that was what I was hoping to do, is to get exposure so I could do this. I think what I do is truly something that can transcend to any type of venue. I'd love to do corporate gigs. I would love to talk to children. I'm working with Girls Inc. to do inspirational talks for them.
Are you in a rush now? We could fill the studio with water and we can just see.
I don't think I'd fill the studio because I believe there's some electrical things here.
That's right. Yeah.
So is there a website where people can find you guys? What is it?
It's alexandriathegreat.com. And it has.
And the spelling of it is Alexander. This is my fault on mm-hmm. this. The spelling is Alexander IA.
Okay.
Because a lot of people have kind of missed that a little bit. So I've had to do a little tweaking to be able to make sure people get to the website. But it's AlexanderIAthegreat.com.
Now, Bill, you're the teammate, manager, whatever. One of the things I was thinking about, I'm saying, so if your wife decides when I'm reading all this stuff and watching this morning, she doesn't want to do this anymore, I'm sure you thought, she can just pick locks for a living. I'm serious. I mean, the potential. So what's next for you, Alexandria the Great?
Well, we're hoping to get some sponsors so that we can go on to some bigger and better things. I would like to work on a different variation of Houdini's water torture cell, which, you know, is something that we've been exploring. But in order to do that, you do need sponsors. So
we're also hoping, too, that in terms of, you know, again, she talked about corporate stuff, working with Girls Inc. We're still on America's Got Talent. So there's a chance that we could be called back on the wild card show.
Which would be cool. Fantastic. Now, okay, when will you find out about that?
We're hoping within the next couple of weeks. And if that's
great.
The case, we'd love to be able to kind of go, you know, obviously get some support because it's all about votes in terms of getting
through.
Can people
still vote on that thing? Or
they
we don't know?
Unfortunately. The voting is it's only 2 hours after the show and that's it. So it's a small window, which makes it kind of difficult.
Yeah.
And what she does, it's hard. You know, when a singer sings, it's like, oh, it's a great song. As an escape artist, you want to be able to get them out of their seats. We got them out of their seats, you know, and that was great. But sometimes it's hard to go, ooh, I like that better than a singer. So
yeah. It's
been hard with Dangerous Acts.
Hey, Bill and Alex Purnell and Alexandria the Great in particular, your stuff is spectacular.
Thank
and
you.
We're really glad you came visit
yeah,
us.
Yeah, you have got unbelievable courage. I couldn't put my finger in a tank, never mind my whole self.
Marjorie jokes, the only thing I can do in water is doggy paddle. And I'm not even that good at doggy paddling. Hey, Alex and Bill, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much
thank
for
you
being
for
here.
Really
this has
it.
Been wonderful. Thank you.
Houdini's torture cell, a woman from Medway.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I won't be trying that.
Nor will I. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. You're not going to want to miss this. Washington Post bought by Jeff Bezos from Amazon yesterday. John Henry buys the Globe on Saturday. Globe editor Brian McGorry joins us at about 1 o'clock to talk about the future of newspapers. I think Marjorie want to listen to that. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
You can follow us at BOS Public Radio. Me at Jim Browdy. Marjorie at Marjorie Egan on Twitter. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Thanks so much for being here.